Welcome to Songcraft. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. You're listening to The Way We Were, recorded by Barbara Streisand and co-written by our guest on this episode of Songcraft, Alan Bergman. Alan Bergman and his late wife Marilyn joined forces professionally in the 1950s to create one of the most successful songwriting teams of all time. Though both musicians, the pair are best known as lyricists, and they found particular success writing for the silver screen. The Bergmans earned 11 Grammy nominations, including 4 nominations for Song of the Year. They won the Song of the Year honor for The Way We Were from the Barbra Streisand film of the same name. They received 15 Academy Award nominations for Best Original Song, winning twice for The Windmills of Your Mind and The Way We Were, and earning a record-setting 3 nominations in a single year in 1982. The following year, they won their 3rd Oscar for Best Original Song Score for the Yentl soundtrack, which included Best Original Song nominees Papa Can You Hear Me and The Way He Makes Me Feel. Other highlights from the Bergman catalog include Nice and Easy, performed by Frank Sinatra, The Summer Knows, recorded by Sarah Vaughan, You Don't Bring Me Flowers, which they wrote with Neil Diamond, Someone in the Dark, which Michael Jackson recorded for the E.T. soundtrack, and I Knew I Loved You, which was recorded by Celine Dion. Additionally, the 4-time Emmy Award winners were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame and were recipients of the National Music Publishers Association Lifetime Achievement Award. The Bergmans held a number of executive positions in various organizations, including serving on the executive committee of the music branch of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and as board members of the National Academy of Songwriters. From 1994 to 2009, Marilyn served as the president of ASCAP. Their songs have been recorded by Fred Astaire, Johnny Mathis, Sergio Mendez, Ray Charles, Bing Crosby, Stan Getz, Dusty Springfield, Diana Ross, Gladys Knight, Glenn Campbell, Sting, Natalie Cole, Tony Bennett, Nora Jones, and countless others. We're thrilled to share this conversation with the now 98-year-old Alan Bergman, recorded at his home back in August.
Part 1.
All right, dude, so what's the deal? Like, I saw you earlier today. You're driving on the left side of the road. You've been talking in this weird accent today. You ordered sticky toffee pudding for lunch. I don't even know. What is that?
I've just come back from London, mate.
This accent, this is what I'm talking about. What?
Yeah, I just came back from London.
Well, that explains it.
I am jet lagged. I do not know what day or time it is, but here I am. I am awake. And yep. I am, you know, functioning, sort of.
Well, I appreciate you coming back to do the show. You know, we got stuff we got to take care of here. You can't just be flying around the world.
No.
You had some business meetings. You saw some friends. And you also saw a pretty remarkable show.
I went to the ABBA Voyage show. And for those who might not know what that is, it is a show featuring the band ABBA in avatar form. So ABBA's not there, but the 4 members of ABBA did this sort of like super expensive motion capture thing with Industrial Light and Magic, which is George Lucas's company. Yeah. And basically what they've done is they've created 3-dimensional human. I mean, it looks so real, dude.
Avatars, right?
It looks so real.
Wow.
And it is wild. And so they've got these big screens on the side of the stage that are doing close-ups of their faces. And that looks like a 95% human. It's very good.
Yeah.
But the thing I couldn't get past was the figures on the stage. I was sitting about 20 yards away, so I wasn't super far. And I was like, this must be actors. This must be live humans that are here. But it's not. It's all done with lights and Jeez. You know, and so then they have a live band, and these avatars are performing all of ABBA's hits, and it's actually the 4 original members went in and redid the vocals, so they didn't pull the vocals off.
Oh, really?
Off the record. Yeah, so these are new live vocals. The band's been broken up for like 40 years, so nobody has seen ABBA perform in real life for, you know, decades, and the whole thing just sounds so bizarre that I had to go. I was like, wow. I want to see what this is, see if I can figure out how in the world they did it. It is bonkers. I mean, I am not like, I respect ABBA's music. I think they wrote great pop songs. But I'm not like a hardcore ABBA fan. So right. I didn't know every, so I knew about 6 songs. But Just the spectacle of it, the production value of it. I mean, when you spend $175 million to produce something, it's going to be pretty great. Yeah. And the sound system was unreal. The live band was unreal. And the thing that was almost unsettling about it was that you can't bring a phone in and take photos and videos. So everyone is like far more engaged with this illusion than we typically see people at a real concert by real performers, because they're sort of messing around with their phones or taking video or photos or whatever. So everyone's fully engaged, and the avatars even kind of come out between songs and talk and interact with the audience. People are like whistling and cheering at certain things as if they are responding to and interacting with a real human, which they are not. And there was an encore at the end, which is wild. And then at the very end, the members of ABBA come out on stage appearing as they look now, like as the older versions of themselves. And I am convinced that like half the place thought it was really ABBA. I mean, people were losing their minds. They're stomping, they're clapping super hard, they're cheering and screaming. I think some of these people believed that like, oh yeah, the members of ABBA actually come here every single night and appear on stage. But the thing sold out. It sold out all the time. I tried to go last year when my wife and I were in London and we couldn't get tickets. So I managed to get like one ticket while I was there, and it was the day of. I just happened to sort of squeeze in, and it was just wild. I've never seen anything like it.
You know, when I hear about this, I can't help, you know, thinking about the early days of rock and roll, and I'm thinking about guys like Sam Phillips. I'm thinking about Alan Freed, or I'm thinking about even somebody like Ike Turner, and I just think, this is what they envisioned. This was what the originators and the pioneers of rock and roll always knew.
Always
would
imagined.
Come to.
Yeah, right. It's like science fiction, dude. It's like if somebody described this to us 10 years ago, we would go, well, nobody could ever do anything
right.
like that.
I mean, the thing is, like, you know, it's funny. I joke around about the pioneers of rock and roll, but I would absolutely go to see an Elvis show like this, you know? I think there are certain acts that you would... that maybe would lend themselves to this type of production more than others. You know, I'm not sure that the James Taylor show is going to have the bombast
that
it needs, or you know, but yeah, like they're going to do it with Kiss. And I think that makes all the sense in the world.
Right. Yeah. And it raises questions of sort of legacy and what does a band mean? You know, because I even saw, like, I think it was Gene or Paul of Kiss had said in an interview that, like, you know, we might even like just handpick some new musicians and have them go out, because Kiss are kind of avatars anyway, you know, like they're playing characters. And they were saying, well, we might even just, you know, pick some new guys and have them go out. And I thought, well, that's kind of ridiculous. But then I thought, well, you know, I recently saw Blind Boys of Alabama in concert, and none of those guys are the original dudes. Right. That band started like back in the 30s or something. And even more extreme, you have like the Fisk Jubilee Singers. That goes back to the Civil War. There's still a Fisk Jubilee Singers today. And so what are you going to see when you go see that show? You're kind of going to see the celebration of the legacy of what that quote unquote brand represents, in the way that somebody could say, well, I was a Seattle Seahawks fan in the 80s and I'm still a Seattle Seahawks fan. None of the same people are involved, you know.
Kids Incorporated,
for example.
Yeah, for all of you who are under the age of 45, that's something that was on TV when we were kids. I digress.
But yeah, it does sort of make you think, like, what are our attachments to certain people, or to the brand, or to the nostalgia, or to the memories? And, you know, just the degree to which they pulled off this show and made everything about it feel real, even though you mentally know the whole time that it is a facsimile of something original. It was still a thrill. It was wild.
I think it's all about an experience, you know, and there are some experiences that we read about that we never had the chance to be a part of. And whether it be some of these iconic shows that we know of, or just an iconic period in a band's career. And you can go see Elton John right now.
Yeah.
You know, and Elton John's great right now.
Yeah.
That farewell tour was great. All three times I saw it. But to see Elton in 1972 or 1973 is a different thing altogether. And I wasn't able to do that. And if someone gave me the opportunity to experience that kind of show, what's weird about it though, is that I think some of what we sort of fetishize, or, you know, like really treasure about these experiences is all of it.
Yeah.
And you can't get all of it.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to get a $75 hot dog at the Elton show like I would have in 1973.
Or 75 cents. You could get a $75 hot
dog. Did I say a 75? That actually I probably could get now in the farewell tour. I think I may have done that.
That you could, right. No, but you can't get all the things that go along with it.
You know, the room was full of cigarette smoke, which is not necessarily a great thing, but the lighting sure looked cool back then. You know, I think there's a magic, and if it can be captured, then these things are probably going to be unbelievable.
Yeah.
And sometimes maybe the music is enough, and maybe the spectacle and the costumes and all that kind of stuff. I need to go see one. I need to sort of see what my response to it is.
If anybody is going to London, I highly recommend just going to this. It's almost just even to observe the audience. I mean, it's a sociological experiment almost, seeing how people are reacting to something like this. And, you know, it felt weird in a lot of ways, even though it was like fun.
Right.
But then I think, if you told me like, hey man, last night I watched this Elton John concert film from 1975. It was so good. I wouldn't say like, dude, why are you sitting on your couch in the year 2024 watching a 1975 concert? That's weird.
Like, but you know what I didn't do? I didn't clap at the end of it.
Well, that's a good point. But in a way, it's sort of like, well, what if you were going with a group of people to watch a classic era concert? You're just immersing yourself in the experience more. In both instances, you're recognizing that, like, I'm not really there, but I am sort of putting myself there by virtue of watching this concert film. And even more so if I were able to go sort of replicate the whole experience. So, you know, maybe it's not that weird as long as we recognize its limitations and what it is, and we still can, as humans, distinguish reality from fiction.
I'm thinking of like possible expansions of this technology. Number one, like to see maybe like a sporting event, like see Ali Frazier, see them fight again, go to Madison Square Garden and see like a classic fight. Or maybe I can have an avatar in the passenger seat and I can use the carpool lane. Like, is there a way
to use that technology?
I'm looking at you, Tesla. You know, you guys are doing so much innovative stuff with your automobiles. Can you give me an avatar?
Yeah.
So that I can use the carpool.
And can it be a member of ABBA?
Insane. That would be incredible.
Or you could change it out. You'd be like, I want to ride with Barry Gibb today.
Yeah.
And then you turn on the stereo in the car and the avatar next to you is singing whatever. Yeah. I mean, there's great possibilities.
Yeah. I mean, think of the people you could do this podcast with. You know, you could you could pick anybody.
Right.
Abraham Lincoln. We're going to talk about
Our guest on today's episode of Songcraft is Stephen Foster. I mean, it's pretty wild because it starts blurring. I mean, even just when you think about AI and the way that people can make these deep fake videos, and we are rapidly advancing as a society into areas that the implications for some of these things, we have no idea. And it is like there is a dimension to these things that is frightening to think that I could create a video of I could have a video of you on camera committing a crime that could be completely falsified. You know, it's wild to think about the incredible entertainment value of this kind of technology, but also like the way that this sort of thing can be used for nefarious purposes. It's unsettling.
Yeah. When you think about, you know, technology and the speed at which it is advancing, and the frontiers that are ahead of us, it sort of underscores, the fact that we've interviewed a 98-year-old songwriter this week. And to think about the things that he's seen.
Yeah.
I think we started off this conversation with Alan Bergman, talking about a cut with Bing Crosby.
Right. And being working and counting as a mentor, Johnny Mercer.
Right.
Who just seems like a lifetime ago.
We were talking about the advent of music on television and you know, marrying music to scripts and things like that. And I mean, even the changes in the way movies are presented.
Right.
And the way songs have to be constructed to fit all these different formats.
Right.
I mean, between the early 20th century to now.
Right.
And he's alive for this moment. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And that is almost even more wild than seeing an avatar of ABBA is sitting down with a man who has been writing songs professionally for literally 80 years and hearing his stories. And I think the most kind of exciting and fun part of it that the listeners will not get to experience, but we did, is when we were done recording and it kind of put everything away, he said, hey, you guys want to want me to read you these lyrics to a song that I wrote yesterday. And he pulled out this song and he had this like spark in his eye.
Yep.
I mean, he was sort of like, and you're going, wow, he is jazzed about the song that he wrote yesterday. This guy has written a gajillion songs.
Totally.
He's been doing this forever and he's still excited about it.
And it was a good song.
And to see a guy like that who's been doing it that long and is not jaded, he's still just passionate about the love. It's all about the love of the song. I mean, those kind of moments are why we do this show. Just to even remember, like, we've got wild technology now. We've got things that can be done that we would have never imagined 10 years ago, but there's still no replacement for like real life creativity and somebody who's just making something up out of thin air with their own imagination and being excited about it. And I think no matter what technology we wind up having down the road, we have to preserve that. We have to preserve that thing of like real people making real things from their own real ideas and writing out a song that they're just excited about because they made it and here's my song and I worked on it and I'm happy with it. That is the real deal.
Amen. And speaking of that, imagine you're a writer who's just written a song.
I will.
Enthusiastic about it.
Okay.
And you want everybody else to be enthusiastic about it.
Sure.
Part of that involves getting the right recording, don't you think?
Absolutely.
If you got a crappy recording, nobody's going to be enthusiastic about your song.
No, they're not going to like it.
And not everybody has the training and bought the gear and all this stuff to come out with a really solid professional sounding recording. But you know who's done it? Justin and his team of avatars at Pearl Snap Studios. He's cloned himself and they're all handsome and they're all young and energetic.
Charming
and fake. None of them are real humans, but I'm kidding. Justin has a team of real humans at Pearl Snap that can take your song from its sort of genesis point to a place of absolute beauty and professionalism that you can be proud to show anybody and be enthusiastic about.
Yeah, and if you have listened to Songcraft for any amount of time, you know that Justin is a good friend of ours and that we believe in what he does at Pearl Snap Studios. So go to pearlsnapstudios.com, find out everything they can do for you, whether you've got just a very rough kind of version of a song that you've put onto your iPhone and it's just kind of you humming the melody and playing along and mapping it out. They can take something that rough and turn it into something amazing. So whether it's a demo or whether you want to make an independent album of your own, whatever it is, check it out, pearlsnapstudios.com. Tell Justin that Scott and Paul sent you and you will get a discount on your first recording.
Part two.
Alan, welcome to Songcraft.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us into your beautiful home. It's great to sit here in your home office with you and look around at all the awards and accolades and achievements. It's quite inspiring. But I want to go back to before the awards and before the achievements. I understand that you were born in Brooklyn, September 11th, 1925, which if my math is right, you'll be 98 here very soon.
Yeah, a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Can't wait to hear some of the insights you have from your years as a songwriter. But talk to us a little bit about being a kid growing up in Brooklyn. When did music kind of capture your attention in a special way? When did it capture you where you kind of thought, huh, I might want to get involved in that?
Well, music was a very important element in our house. Growing up in Brooklyn, when you were 6 years old and you were Jewish in Brooklyn, you took piano lessons automatically. My wife, my late wife, also born in Brooklyn, also 6 years old, took piano lessons. My mother took me to the New York Philharmonic, had children's concerts every Saturday, free. She took me there every Saturday morning.
Wow.
So I learned a great deal.
Yeah.
And I had friends a few years later in my teens. For instance, it was during the great band, big band era in American music. And they were the first cellist and the first violist of the NBC Symphony Orchestra, Tuscanese Orchestra. And they left me a pass every Monday, and I would go and sit in the back of Studio 8H in NBC in New York and listen to Benny Goodman's band rehearse.
Wow.
Jeez.
And it was a great time.
Yeah.
I had a lot of music in my youth, a lot. And I loved it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the big band era was the golden era of music in this country for one reason. Besides having the great writers of the Great American Songbook doing their best work, but the music that you heard, the public, music that the public heard, was chosen by musicians. Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller, and so forth. Those band leaders, they chose the music that you heard on the radio, and it was music that they chose from either the Broadway shows or the movies.
Wow.
And they were written by, you know, Johnny Mercer, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, the great writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you say they chose the music, you mean kind of removing that barrier of the A&R person or that type of thing?
There was no, you know.
Right.
At the end of the 50s, when the 60s started, and it was the end of the big band era, then unfortunately businessmen who wanted to sell records started to choose who wrote it and so on.
Yeah.
And the melodies went out the window.
Huh.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about hits now. I'm talking about good writing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've read somewhere that you knew by around the age of 11 or 12 that you wanted to be a songwriter.
Yeah, 13. Yeah.
And then I've read that you got sheet music to a song called Lost. And we're going to talk a lot about Johnny Mercer today.
Well, he was my mentor.
Well, and even before meeting him, apparently he was one of the writers of the very first piece of sheet music that you bought.
Oh, absolutely.
And so how did that kind of morph, you know, from you buying sheet music and learning how to play it to saying, hey, I think I want to write a song of my own? Do you remember the first song that you ever wrote?
Yeah. I was about 12, 13 in a subway. They had at the end of the car a big poster of a woman, and it was she was Miss Subways for a week or two, and then they changed and it became some other woman or girl. And I wrote a song called I Want to Be Miss Subway. I have my picture in all the cars, just like movie star. You know.
That's great.
That was it.
Right. Well, kind of walk us through, you said Johnny Mercer was a mentor to you.
Oh, yeah.
Walk us through how you went from being a kid buying sheet music to a Johnny Mercer song to knowing Johnny Mercer and actually counting him as a mentor.
I met him when I was in graduate school at UCLA. And he took a liking to me, thank goodness. And he spent a lot of time with me. And, you know, I can't go through all that he taught me, but one of the things was that I should write to a melody instead of writing lyrics. Get a melody and so on. When I was still in graduate school, he was producing an album of Bing Crosby and Louis Armstrong. And he said, go home and write him a duet. You know,
well, no pressure.
In which I did.
Yeah.
And I came back, I sang it to Johnny. He said, perfect. And they recorded it.
Wow.
He produced it and they recorded it.
Let's sing an old Dixieland song.
Here we'll try.
Our blues will go rolling along.
Right on by.
We'll sing a bass and sweet tune. It's got the kind of beat
that's swinging and sweet tonight.
Now let's sing like a Dixieland band.
I'm feeling right.
It's got a sound that is grand,
light and bright.
I know better music in all the land.
I understand.
Funny. Yeah, yeah. On the day Bing Crosby came over to me and he said, Alan, I love your song, he said, but you've written an opportunity for me and Lewis to scat sing. He said, I can't scat sing with Lewis Armstrong. And he said, can you rewrite it so I don't have to scat sing?
Right.
And Johnny came over, heard the conversation. He came over to me, he said, welcome to show business, kid. Wow. And I went over in the corner and rewrote it because Billy May had the orchestra. The orchestration was already made, and they were going to record it in about an hour.
Wow. Yeah.
So
now, I was digging deep. I found a song from 1955 called The White Buffalo that you wrote solo. That was recorded by an artist named Bill Hayes on Cadence Records.
Yeah, it was for a television show.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in those days, I was writing both music and lyric.
Right. Mm.
But I found that when I got further into writing songs, that I wrote with people who wrote better than I did musically.
Hmm.
And I was only interested in writing a good song.
Yeah.
The best song I could.
Just trying to get my brain around, you know, the timeline of, you know, you got the White Buffalo, you got the Bing Crosby, Louis Armstrong, which I think was Let's Sing Like a Dixieland Band. Was one of those actually your very first cut, or was there something else that was your very first recorded song?
The Walter Schumann Choir, Johnny Mercer, gave them a song of mine, and they recorded it.
Ah.
Wow.
I wish I could remember the name of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 97. So.
Yeah. We'll cut you some slack.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that both you and your wife Marilyn were from Brooklyn, and I understand you were actually born at the same hospital at different times. But
same
you
hospital as Barbara Streisand.
Is that right?
Oh, wow.
Wow. So there must have been something in the water in that neighborhood.
Exactly.
I guess. But you and Marilyn had not met up until around this time in your life, and there was a common collaborator named Lou Spence.
Lou Spence.
And I guess he was the one that suggested.
She was writing with Lou.
Got it.
And Lou said, she was writing with him in the afternoon. I was writing with him in the morning.
Wow.
And he said one day, I'm going to introduce you to my afternoon lyric writer. And we went up to Marilyn's house, had a little lunch, and we said, let's write a song. And the three of us wrote a song, and we never stopped writing together.
Wow.
Yeah, I can hardly imagine a more fateful day. I mean, did you know right away that you had
found quite a... I knew in the process.
Wow.
Right away that it was, you know. And the song was called, I Never Knew What Hit Me. You came from out of the blue, caught off guard, and something.
It's almost as if you were writing about each other. It's almost
maybe.
Well, 1956, Mal Fitch recorded "Nice and Easy," which you and Marilyn wrote with Lou Spence. But of course, the best known version of that song is the Sinatra version, which you know.
Yeah.
Was
who did you say before?
Mal Fitch.
I have no idea who that is.
I don't think history does either. But Sinatra?
No, we didn't. Lou Spence knew Sinatra's manager.
Oh, okay.
And Sinatra's manager said to Lou, we're doing an album of Frank's of slightly swinging love songs.
Yeah.
See if you can write him a theme song.
Ah.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know who this other person is.
Yeah.
But.
So it was written for Sinatra.
So you knew.
It was written for Frank.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Well, I think we just discovered that maybe there's some misinformation on the internet.
That's impossible.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
No, we never showed it to anybody else.
Wow. Right.
So we're talking about now the end of the 50s, which was the end of the big band era. in the beginning of A&R men, as you said.
Right.
Now, in writing, for us, we were not interested in writing hits. The publishers in those days said to us, you two might as well quit. You're never going to make any money. Because we were not interested in what the current fad was or anything. We were interested in writing the best song we could write.
Sure.
And in the groove of the Great American Songbook.
Yeah.
And we found out in writing this song for Frank, you know, Frank had a character. You could write a song to fit his character. And that's what we did with Nice and Easy.
Yeah. Wow.
We knew it would fit him like a glove.
Wow.
And he did, and it became the first number one album he ever had.
Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and don't you worry. We're gonna fall in love.
So we knew that we would either write for the movies or for Broadway. Now, we wrote a song within the first year that two great songwriters who were also businessmen, Frank Lesser and Julie Stein, those two, they heard that song, called us, both of them, called us and said, you have to write a Broadway show.
Huh.
Now, we had only been writing together for about a year or so. And Frank Lesser brought us to New York. He had a big publishing firm. He had two teams of writers under contract. And after going talking and so forth, he said, I want to put you on the contract. And we turned him down.
Ah,
well.
And people thought we were crazy. and he was very angry. We said, Mr. Lesser, we don't know who we are yet.
Wow.
We're just starting to write, and we'd love to take it, but we don't know yet.
Huh.
Yeah. Wow. He said, okay, angrily, but I got to publish that song. Now, the song is a very interesting song. It was a song that said, I've been everywhere, I've done everything, and I've never left your arms. That's what the song said.
Yeah.
And that was what it was called, I've Never Left Your Arms. And they loved that song, these two great writers.
Yeah.
And that opened the door for us in a lot of ways.
You know, you mentioned writing for a character when you write for Frank Sinatra, and then you guys had some incredible success with writing for films. And I'm curious to know how that process worked. You know, how much of the script did you get ahead of time? How much did you know about the film when you went in to craft a lyric for that movie?
If the movie could have been still being shot. Mm. So we read the script, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I can give you two examples of songs that we wrote for movies that was specifically written for a situation. For instance, in the Thomas Crown Affair, the director, Norman Jewison, marvelous director, who absolutely knew how to use songs, not as titles or in titles, but part of the fabric of a movie. He said to us, I have a scene in this movie where Steve McQueen is flying a glider and he has just masterminded the robbery of a bank. Now, He didn't need the money or anything, but it was very successful. And he was flying this glider, which usually is very joyful, worried, anxious, because he didn't know what to do with the money. And Norman said to us, I want you to write a song that underlines the anxiety, the character is feeling at that moment. Now, psychologically, anxiety is a circular emotion. And before we even started to write that song, we wrote down all the circular images we could think of. And we told Michelle about that, and he wrote the melody, because we wrote to the melody. And so that's why it's round, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on and ever spinning. That's all circular, because anxiety is circular. You know, when you're anxious and you go try to go to sleep, you can't turn it off.
Yeah,
the mind keeps going. That's anxiety, and that's what that song is
like
about.
Like a windmill, yeah.
Yeah.
Circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on a never spinning reel, like a snowball down a mountain or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills.
And that earned you your first Academy Award for Best Original Song.
Yeah.
Which is a phrase that you got used to hearing over the course of your career.
Well, it's interesting you talk about, you know, writing for a story. You know, writing for something specific versus writing just for whatever. And between 1968 and 1973, you guys were nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Song every year within that span. So we really see this explosion that had kind of begun with, you know, writing lyrics for In the Heat of the Night that Quincy Jones produced and Ray Charles sang. That kind of launched into this thing, and Windmills of Your Mind was this huge moment. And then it just, you rode that wave, and it's became very much about writing these songs for movies, where you have an assignment, so to speak. You have a concept. I'm curious if that's how you and Marilyn always worked. Did you ever just kind of come up with stuff that might be for whatever, or did you always kind of like to work from, we know exactly what we're aiming at here?
Oh, no, we wrote every day, and if we weren't hired, we would write. You know, you get ideas or something. Mm.
Yeah.
And Michelle Legrand, a great melody writer, and we were working with wonderful Dave Grusin, fantastic melody writer, Marvin Hamlisch, and we were very connected to the jazz field. And people in the jazz field used to call and say, I got this tune. Can I come and play it for you?
Mm.
And if we liked the tune, we would write to it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was actually going to ask you about that process, because you mentioned a number of different composers, you know, Michelle Legrand being one that you worked with many, many times. Did it always happen in terms of you're in the room together and there's a piano and here's the melody? Were you ever sent tapes, like reel-to-reels, to listen to, and then you just put them on in the house and listen and see if it inspired you?
Absolutely. They would send us tunes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And did you, was that, because I imagine this process of someone coming to your house with a melody and they're sitting down to play it, and you've got to either say, I like that or I don't, which could either maybe be a little bit uncomfortable. If you've got a reel-to-reel to put on, you can.
Most of the time we would say, leave it and we'll see if we get an idea.
Got it.
Ah.
Got it. Yeah. So you didn't have to let them know face-to-face whether you like the idea or not.
Yeah. Well, that Michelle Legrand partnership was extremely fruitful, and there's dozens of things we could point to, but he did basically an entire album with Sarah Vaughan. And at the 1972 Grammys, you were nominated for Song of the Year for The Summer Knows, which was written for that project. I think you guys wrote most of the lyrics for that.
Yeah, we did.
The summer knows, and unashamed, she sheds her clothes. The summer smooths the restless sky.
Talk a bit about that project and what you recall about working on those songs.
Well, Michelle had a great taste for wonderful singers. Mm-hmm. You know, Sarah being one of them. So he came to us with some melodies and said, these are for Sarah, would you write? Which we did.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow.
It's wonderful to, you know, have a great voice to write for.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Barbara Streisand has recorded over 60 songs of ours.
Wow.
And she's the best of it.
Yeah. You know, as the 70s moved along, you know, you mentioned Dave Grusin, and he's someone that you wrote theme songs for television series with.
Yeah.
I think of the Sandy Duncan Show, Maude, Good Times, and then a few years later, writing the theme song to the TV show Alice. Within some circles, you know, they would have considered film as being an elevated type of medium, and that TV wasn't quite as sophisticated, but these songs are amazing songs. How did you look at your work in film compared to your work in TV?
Well, in TV, you know, you only have 45 seconds to grab an audience in the beginning of a show. And to have, again, like a great director, a great producer, Norman Lear, who said, you know, you guys know what to do. When we came to him with Maude, which was a kind of a gospel song for a white lady, he said, great, perfect. You know, he had those things worked. And Good Times, the black community. Marilyn gave, when she was president of ASCAP, had to give a talk in Atlanta. And the black community there, there was about, over 500 in attendance to this talk she had to give. And they could not believe that two white people who wrote Good Time.
Right.
Good time, any time you need a payment. Good time, any time you need a friend. Good time, any time you're out from under. Not getting hustled, keeping your head above water. Making a way when you can.
Temporary layoffs.
Good times.
Easy credit rip-offs.
Good times.
Scratching and surviving.
Let's have a Barbara Streisand moment here, because you mentioned she did over 60 of your songs.
Yeah.
You won your second Academy Award for The Way We Were, which you guys wrote with Marvin Hamlisch, and of course performed by Barbara Streisand in the film of the same name. But you also won two Grammys for that song. You won a Golden Globe for that song. Mm. I mean, this song was huge. And we often talk with songwriters that some songs become so big that you just take them for granted. It's like they've always existed. And it's easy to forget that, well, this was once people in a room working through ideas. I would love to hear how that song was put together.
Well, that song, like Windmills, that song had a purpose. If you remember the movie, in the movie, Barbara's character, by accident, sees the Redford character at a bar, and he's drunk, and she fixes his hair.
Right.
And they haven't seen each other since college, And the song was a courier back into time.
Yeah.
Took you back into. And so she's going, memory is made. And it takes you all the way back to when they were in college together.
Yeah.
Now, the same thing, it had to pay off too at the end of the movie where they meet again by accident.
Right.
And you hear the last part of that song. If you know, Marvin said, if they're not crying at the end of this, we haven't done our job. You know, and they did.
Memories like the corners of my mind. Misty watercolor memories of the way. Pictures of the smiles we left behind, smiles we gave to one another for the way we were.
I mean, that's such a perfect marriage of melody and lyric, because it's a wistful melody. The melody itself that begins to communicate that feeling of nostalgia. Oh,
he was wonderful. Now I'll tell you something funny that people don't know. When we finished playing the way we were, that you know, for Ray Stark, who was the producer, Sidney Pollack, who was the director, Barbara and her manager, at Barbara's house in Beverly Hills. When we finished, they all said, it's wonderful, thank you, it's great, and so forth. Her manager said, knowing the release of the movie date and so forth, said, it's going to be the number one song in the country in July, whatever. And we were overjoyed that they loved it. Now, the three of us, meaning Marilyn, myself, and Marvin, say goodbye. And as we're leaving, we said to Marvin, let's write a couple of more songs called The Way We Were. He says, what are you, crazy? They love this song. And we said, a little crazily ourselves, we don't write for them.
Mm.
She's not going to record this song for 2 months. They were still shooting the movie. So we got time. We could write a tango. We could write a waltz. And he wrote another melody.
Really?
And we wrote another song.
Wow.
Called The Way We Were. And we played it for Barbara and Sidney Pollack. And they loved it. And we said the best way to find out which is the best for the movie is that Barbara sing both songs and lay it against the images.
Wow.
Which she did.
Yeah.
Which she did. And we, and the song that everybody knows, the first song we wrote, worked like gangbusters with the book. The other song was a lovely song, but it's a little more smart. It was a little smarter song. And if you want to hear it, Barbara recorded it, one of her albums. It's called The Way We Weren't. And it's on.
Wow.
She recorded
it. Yeah. That's amazing.
Well, and you continued to have traction with Barbara. I mean, you got a Grammy nomination for your contributions to the Star Is Born soundtrack. And then I think about the song You Don't Bring Me Flowers. And what's really striking to me about that song is that you guys wrote that with Neil Diamond, am I correct, for
the duet? Yeah, Norman Lear called us and said, He wanted Neil Diamond to write a theme for him. And would we write the lyric? And we said, oh, sure, why not? And he sent us a script. We read the script. And we wrote, you know, a theme for a television show is only 45 seconds long. And once he sent us the script, the song didn't fit anymore.
Wow.
So we called Neil and said, you know, got to write another song, and called Norman and said, you can't use it. And Neil said, I've been playing this from my crew here. He was on a road somewhere. And everybody loves it. I'm going to record it. I said, you can't record it. It's 45 seconds long. He said, okay, when I come back, we'll write it. But I don't have time to write another song. So Marilyn and I wrote a talking blues for the television show. It's called Something According to Norman Lear. And he used it, you know. And that was the beginning of You Don't Bring Me Flowers.
Wow.
Interesting.
And then Neil came back and we finished the song. And he recorded it, and Barbara heard it, and she recorded it.
I mean, Neil has a real signature lyrical style. I'm curious how that worked, collaborating together with someone who had such strong...
Well, he didn't write any of the
lyrics. He didn't write any of the lyrics. He wrote the melody.
Yeah.
And you guys were interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it became a hit by accident. A guy, a disc jockey in Kentucky, was having trouble with his wife. And he put the two together and played it on the air. Barbara's version and Neil's version. And the phones went off. Where can we buy this record?
Wow.
It didn't exist.
That's amazing.
It didn't exist. And so they, Columbia Records, because of the response, insisted they record a duet, which they did, and, you know, became a hit.
That's incredible.
We were not in the business of writing his song.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, you were more writing for the screen, and suddenly, yeah. Well, one more Barbara question. We could, of course, talk about Barbara all day with all the stuff she's done, you know, with you guys' songs. But you and Marilyn had two Best Original Song Oscar nominations in 1983, but they were both from the film Yentl, for Papa Can You Hear Me and The Way He Makes Me Feel. And that was such a big movie. And, you know, I think Papa Can You Hear Me is one of those songs that is just almost seared into, you know, our culture. I'd love to hear a little bit about that project.
Oh, that was a wonderful project. We had a wonderful time.
Yeah.
Four of us, that's Michelle, Barbara, Marilyn, and I. And the score was a pleasure to write.
Yeah.
And, you know, we would finish the song here and ask Barbara to come over and sing it for us. And she was a great director. It couldn't have been better.
Yeah.
And, you know, this year, it's 40 years, and they're putting out a new CD, a new DVD.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot of, which is good because it deserves it.
Wow.
I think I somehow did not realize that Barbara directed that.
Oh, God. Wonderfully.
Wow.
Wow.
So you had the benefit of having the director,
absolutely,
who was also the singer,
yeah,
who's right there for the whole,
absolutely,
that's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, she's, you know, she's a genius.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, we touched briefly on some of your work with Quincy Jones back in the 60s.
Oh, Quincy.
And
my pleasure.
And honestly, until I saw the Quincy Jones documentary on Netflix recently, I didn't realize how extensive and how early his work had been. I mean, Quincy's been everywhere. You guys kind of reunited with him in 1982 to write the lyrics for Someone in the Dark for Michael Jackson for the E.T. soundtrack. Music was written by Rod Temperton, who many people may know.
Worked with Quincy a lot.
And so many of Michael's hits, Rock With You, Thriller. Yeah. Michael Jackson at the time, I think that was probably just before the release of Thriller, or it was right around the time when he was absolutely taking over the world. At this point in your career, when you've had so many big moments, does something like that, did it feel like a high, did your adrenaline even rise at that point to be working with Michael Jackson? Or were you like, oh, another artist, another song?
No. I mean, you know, when Quincy knocked on our door, this is a few years before that, and said, I would like you to write a song for a movie I'm doing that Ray Charles is going to, then.
Yeah, yeah.
That made us feel, oh, boy, Ray Charles.
Yeah. Well, around that same time, 1982, you guys were nominated for 3 of the 5 Academy Award for Best Original Song, which was, it set a record. I don't think anyone else had ever had 3 of the 5 nominations in the same year. But you look at the songs, and we're talking about How Do You Keep the Music Playing from Best Friends, which you guys wrote with Michel Legrand. We're talking about If We Were in Love from Yes, Giorgio, which you wrote
with
John Williams.
John Williams.
Mm. Yeah. And then,
who, incidentally, is a great songwriter.
Is that right?
Doesn't like to write songs.
Yeah.
But the first picture he ever wrote the score for was a picture called Fitzwillie.
Huh.
And we wrote a wonderful song with him called Make Me Rainbows.
Hmm.
That terrific song.
Yeah.
He certainly knows a melody, doesn't he? I mean...
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's a great melody, right?
Yeah, yeah. So you've got Legrand, you've got John Williams, and then you've got Dave Grusin, who we talked about, and you guys wrote It Might Be You from Tootsie.
All of my life, lying on the sand, watching seabirds fly, wishing there would be someone.
That's another one that, you know, Stephen Bishop recorded that. Not only was it successful attached to the movie, it was a top 10 hit. And you said, you know, you guys weren't writing for radio. You weren't writing for records. You were writing for films. You were writing for stories.
That's right.
And, I mean, by the time that now you've had huge hits and Michael Jackson's recording your songs and The Way We Were, you know, was there ever any point when you guys kind of thought, well, maybe we should be writing hits.
No.
Really?
Wow.
No.
Wow.
Now, it's interesting. In Tootsie, they had hired a rock group, I don't know who it was, to write the song. And they were going to pre-record on Tuesday. And Friday, Dave Grusin and Sidney Pollack, the director, called. Dave knew that the rock group, whoever it was, weren't going to make it. And he had written a melody before. And they said, would you do us a favor, write the song for the film? And that afternoon we went and saw the movie and wrote It Might Be You over the weekend.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the breadth of your career, and as I'm looking at these songs, I keep seeing nomination, Academy Award. I keep seeing, you know, a Grammy. I see, you know, the Emmys here. And we talk about songwriters and artists. They talk about the EGOT and the Emmy, the Grammy, the Oscar, and the Tony. And anyone who has, you know, an inkling of understanding about the music business would be overjoyed to have a career like the one that you've had. I mean, I look at the trophies above me. Was there ever a part of you that was like, oh, we want the Tony too? There's just that competitive part of being a songwriter that just wants everything.
No, because we had two horrendous experience, Broadway experiences.
Huh.
And not of our doing. In one case, in trying out a show that Julie Stein produced and all of a sudden wanted to be the director and was not capable of being a director. So in the middle of it, they hired another director when we were in Philadelphia trying out. And the leading man was a man named Arthur Hill, who had won a Tony the year before for a straight play. He couldn't sing or dance, but because he had won a Tony, they hired him.
Wow.
And we had a wonderful woman, Barbara Cook, who became later a big star on Broadway. She was terrific. But it didn't work. And there was a lot of trouble in the switching of directors and the fact that Arthur Hill wasn't capable. It was terrible. And then, years later, with a composer, a very good composer by the name of Billy Goldenberg, we wrote a television musical called Queen of the Stardust Ballroom, which won Emmys and all that stuff. And Michael Bennett, who had just had Chorus Line, called us and said, I want to make a musical out of that. And it was a terrible experience. He thought it was about dancing. It wasn't about dancing at all. And you know, it was a constant fight. And since then, we've had many offers. We didn't want to go back. You know.
I think about the ways that music changes, popular tastes change, and I think, you know, here you were writing songs that Bing Crosby and Louis Armstrong are recording, and then you get into the 80s and the 90s, and you're writing The Girl Who Used to Be that Patty Austin recorded, and, you know, got you another Academy Award nomination and Grammy nomination for Best Original Song. In 1995, you've got Moonlight from the film Sabrina, another with John Williams, nominated again for both Academy Award and Grammy for Best Song for Motion Picture.
I have to tell you, being nominated doesn't make the song any better. What it does is it gives the song a platform.
Sure.
And it gives it a little more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, I think also just being nominated indicates that the song is of a certain quality, you know, that
hopefully
you have to have written a good song. But I think my question in there is I think of, you know, Patty Austin, I think of Sting, you know, singing Moonlight. I think of Sting as almost existing in an entirely different universe than Louis Armstrong. You know, they seem so far removed from each other, yet here you are with a career that's so long-lasting. You're spanning generations. You're spanning musical tastes. Was that something that you and Marilyn consciously said, like, hey, let's keep up with who the newer artists are, let's keep up with what the trends are, or did you just do your thing and they found their home?
No, we just did our thing. You know, I still believe, and Marilyn did too, that the better the song is, the more attention it'll get. You know, and those were the days, you know, when Sting recorded in the second version of the Thomas Crown Affair, he recorded Windmills, you know, for the movie. It has to do with the song. Unfortunately, in the last five or six years, I don't know a song with a melody. Melody's gone.
Yeah.
Well, and there's some. I was actually just looking at these two quotes that I've seen. One from Marilyn and one from you. And Marilyn said, "We never write lyrics without also having the goal of the music. You feel like there are words on the tips of the notes. If it's a really good melody, it wants to sing." And then I've read that you said the rhymes are in the melody.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we play them over and over again until we get an idea that we like. And I was just thinking back to the advice you got from Johnny Mercer that says you always got to write to a melody.
Write to a melody.
But it's amazing that, you know, sometimes advice will fall on either deaf ears or ears that just don't have the ability to do what he's talking about. And you guys have this innate ability to hear melodies, to recognize them, to see when they've got, you know.
They sing.
And but what's amazing, too, is that, as Scott pointed out, you're also talking about melodies that were written in different eras. And it's not like your melodic sensibilities were rooted in the past. Your melodic sensibilities grew along with you. And even to the point now where if you heard a good melody, you'd be able to recognize it. And you're pointing out that you're hearing them.
I write every day.
Wow.
Hmm. Now, in the New York Times, interesting, New York Times Sunday, yesterday, in the magazine section, there's an article about the world's leading astrophysicist. And I am writing a song for a play about this astrophysicist.
Wow.
Huh. Wow. I guess I have to ask, all the songs,
yeah,
all the success, what keeps you writing rather than sitting on the beach with a nice drink in your hand?
I love it. Mm. I just love it. I do it every day. There's a play written about and will be starring Beverly Johnson. Now, you know who Beverly Johnson? Beverly Johnson was the first black model to be on the cover of Vogue magazine years ago.
Yeah.
And she became very important in the black community politically and so forth.
Yeah.
And I'm writing a song for that play with, do you know who Greg Phillinganes is?
Oh, yes. Keyboard player.
Greg.
Yeah.
He's wonderful. And he's writing it with me.
Ah.
Wow.
It opens in New York in January.
Amazing. Wow.
That's so cool.
And with all the things that, you know, that you've tried your hand at, in 2007, we saw your album come out, your first album as lead vocalist for the entire record. Is that something you had always wanted to do and just finally like, yeah, I'm going to do it now? Or was that kind of a new idea at the time for you?
A guy came to me where Marilyn and I, you know, there was a series in New York of lyrics and lyricists. And we did it. And a man after the concert came up to me and said, you're a great singer. I want you to sing. I want to make an album with you. I said, you don't want to do that. And he kept it after me for 2 years. And I said, okay. And he flew Mal and I to Germany where we made this. And it came out pretty
well.
Wow.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out well.
When they made that record, did the producer have some songs in mind, or did you select which songs?
No, I selected.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to ask you about a couple of those songs. One is That Face, which I think is one that you wrote with Lou Spence before Marilyn. Is that right?
I wrote that because I wanted to ask Marilyn to marry me. I didn't have any money. And it was written for her. In those days, Fred Astaire was her favorite singer. You know, Fred Astaire was a great singer.
Yeah.
You know who he is?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. In addition to being a dancer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The greatest writers of those, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, Johnny Mercer, they all wrote for him.
Yeah.
Because he was a great singer.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know how I did it or got the number. I called Fred Astaire and he said, I love young songwriters. I don't record anything that's done in a movie, but come sing it for me. And Lou and I went down to Fred Astaire. I sang the song. He said, I love it. I'm going to sing it next week. Record it. He owned the record company. Ava Records, and he said, and he recorded it.
Wow. So did it, it must have worked because Marilyn said yes. Well, the other song I want to ask you about from that record is Love Like Ours.
Well, we wrote that for each other.
That's yeah, amazing. I've heard you say that you wrote the loves, which I thought, what a neat idea, because if somebody's a songwriter, they might write a love song for the person. But here you are writing together. I think that's yeah. really sweet
Dave
and interesting.
Wrote, came over one day. He's one of those jazz guys who came over and said, what do you think of this tune? We said, leave it.
Yeah.
Mm. He's a wonderful melody writer. Dave.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you know, if there was a movie made about your life, and we were going to make the title one of your songs, mm. is there a song title that you've written that would be the title of the Alan Bergman story?
Well, Love Like Ours would be fine.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting. I think about my own relationship with my wife, you know, and you have days where you're fighting about something. You have days where everything feels great and you think, oh, I wish we could just blow off work and go to the beach or go just do, we're feeling, it's a beautiful spring day. You know, you guys, of course, went through all of those emotions and ups and downs of marriage, but at the same time, you're working, you know, and I'm curious what kind of discipline you had to put in place to say, okay, we can't follow necessarily how we're feeling today. We need to get the work done. How did you kind of come to an agreement of how to structure the working part of your life versus the personal part of your life?
Huh. It just happened. Uh-huh. Nothing studied.
Yeah.
You know, Marilyn had a great career as president of ASCAP.
Yes.
Know? And she's, we had to work around that.
Yeah.
During those years.
Sure.
Well, it sounds like there's nothing that you enjoyed doing more than writing a song, so it felt like it was your recreation almost, and your work at the same time.
Wow. Kind of.
Yeah. Well, you and Marilyn are definitely a powerhouse couple, a phenomenal lyrical team. There's many reasons to admire the two of you, mm-hmm. and it has been such an honor for us just to hear your story.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Songcraft, please take a moment right now to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can keep up with us on Instagram at Songcraft Conversations or Facebook at Songcraft Show. To join our team and help support our content, become a Songcraft patron at patreon.com. Visit patreon.com/songcraftshow.
And you can always find us at songcraftshow.com.